Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thanks, Aaron. Good morning, everyone. I don't like to begin speeches with apologies, but let me do so because I do have to shoot straight off again after I've spoken because it's actually English UK's annual conference yesterday and today, and I have to wrap the conference this afternoon. So, as you'll appreciate, I need to get back. We are constrained on time, so I'll get straight on with this presentation. If you could bring me up the first slide. There we go. Let's look at the top line numbers to start with. In higher education, the data from UKESA, UCAS and HESA, if you compare it all, shows that there were 130,000 EU students in UK higher education. The non-EU total was 298,000, making a total of just over 428,000. That is actually only 14% of the full-time first degree students. And amazingly, however, it is 70% of taught postgrads. We need to remind ourselves of that, I think, because it actually means that if we lost non-UK students, every master's course in the UK would close tomorrow. 70% as an average means that you've got some courses that are 100% and some courses that are 40%. Well, you lose still 40% of your students, a course is probably non-viable. Nearly 50%, nearly half of research degree students as well. However, when you focus it down a bit to non-EU students, and that's usually what we mean by international students, in higher education on full-time first degree courses, it's only 108,000, which is just under 6% of the total. They are, of course, disproportionately valuable, but actually there's an argument to be made that this is much more about postgrad than it is about undergrad courses. To look at the international students by sector, because this is always an interesting comparison, we've seen that there's 428,000 roughly non-UK students in higher education, state higher education. There's roughly 600,000 who come every year to learn English. They're relatively short stay, of course, though the stay ranges between a couple of weeks and a 36-week sort of international foundation year course. That's data from the International Passenger Survey and our own data based on census of our own members. Public boarding schools have only 26,000 students. That's from the Independent Schools Council 2012 census published in April. State sector FE colleges, the most difficult sector in a way to get a handle on. The data isn't really properly centrally collected, but there are roughly 50,000, and that figure, interestingly, has been static for many years now. The private sector further and higher education colleges, which is the sector that above all has been hardest hit by the removal of work rights and by a lot of the visa changes and a lot of the requirements on educational oversight, is 300,000, but almost certainly declining. That makes a grand total of international students, non-UK students by sector of roughly 1.4 to 1.5 million. That's why it's so valuable to the UK. And in fact, if you look at the value, this partly derives from the BIS report of June 2011. Total spending by students in state HE is about 8 billion, state FE about 1 billion, English language, private sector, 2 billion. Of course, both FE colleges and universities also teach English, and that figure is included in the previous two figures. We reckon it's roughly half a billion in terms of English language students in the state sector. Public and boarding schools, though the student number is low, boarding fees now are around £30,000 a year. So those 25, 26,000 students account for £750 million of income. Probably apart from people like at London Business School, they're probably the highest payers in the sector. Private FE and professional training, £2 billion plus. possibly more than that. It's very difficult because many of those students actually tend to live with relatives and so on and economise on their accommodation costs and things like that. However, even allowing for that, at 2009 prices, you get a total of over 14 billion from what international students spend in the UK each year. We shouldn't, of course, say that this is just a financial value. The non-financial value is equally huge and definitely much more long-lasting. The international students tend to be from the upper socioeconomic groups in their own country. They go back and they become opinion leaders and leaders in politics, education and business. Many years ago when I was at the University of London in the Vice Chancellor's office, I did a consultancy project on the Institute of Education. And after surveying all the people who got their PhDs from the Institute, I discovered that virtually every one of them over the last 20 years had become a Minister of Education, a Vice Chancellor, or at the very least a Professor of Education. Virtually every one of them, about 95%. So the affinity value downstream is absolutely enormous, and it's a source of repeat business and recommendation for students, and has wider benefits in terms of trade, diplomacy, international support and world opinion. And also, you would expect me to say this, they usually use British English rather than American or Australian or South African. In terms of routes into UK higher education from within the UK, and this is what I want to focus on, we reckon very roughly that each year around 4,000 students move from public and boarding schools through A-levels and international baccalaureate into UK higher education. Around 5,000 come off state FE colleges, which now have got very well developed links with a number of higher education institutions. The international foundation year programmes and pre-sessional English courses, including those on campus in universities like INTU and so on, contribute around 30,000, and that has grown very significantly over the last few years. And finally, universities running their own pre-sessional type courses, probably another 10,000 or so. There was a recent report done by the Knowledge Partnership based on UCAS data, which covered applications and acceptances between 2008 and 2010 for non-EU students to UK first degree courses. And this derives from that report. There were roughly 200,000 applications. 59% of them came from within the UK, including foundation year and pathways. Some of the countries where applications were more likely to originate from within the UK, in other words, those students perhaps not having year 13 in their own countries had come here to do foundation year, subject top-up and English. Russia 6 times more likely, and China 4.5 times more likely. Interestingly, applicants from within the UK were more likely to succeed getting a university place than home country applicants in 14 out of the top 20 subjects chosen by international students, things like business and management studies, computing, IT, and all those modern variants. International students applying from within the UK were twice as likely to convert into enrolments, i.e. for international directors in HE, they're a much easier sell, if you like, than people still based in their own home countries. And there are fairly good reasons for that. They've come here, they've learnt English here, so they have better English. They have UK qualifications, which are still, despite NARIC and everything, easier to analyse for most people. And usually they have easier proof of funds, quite often because they've got a UK bank account, which UKBA places more reliance on than the Central Bank of Iran, for example. The major point arising from this is that there's a direct link between the feeder route's ability to recruit international students and higher education enrolment rates. And the Knowledge Partnership person who did this research said measures which artificially shrink market interest and recruitment at pre-university level study in the UK will have an impact on international recruitment at undergraduate level because simply it will reduce the volume of applications through this route. In English, what damages the feeder routes will damage UK higher education enrolment before long. In terms of protecting particularly the English language route, therefore there's a shared interest across the sectors, not just because a lot of universities do teach English pre-sessional courses themselves. Jeremy has probably said, oh, the government's never going to remove international students from net migration, you know, we're not going to do anything of that kind. Well, we sponsored a report by the Institute for Public Policy Research, which was published a week ago Monday, which shows that the USA, Canada and Australia do not in fact count students in the net migration total. They count them as temporary migrants and they do not include them in the calculation. The second point, which has got perhaps a bit less media attention, that the IPPR said, and we had a presentation at our conference from Dr. Martin Roos of the Migration Observatory at the University of Oxford, who's an important opinion leader in this area because he's actually on the Migration Advisory Committee. And he confirmed through the modelling that because you now have a 5-year cap on the stay in the UK for most students, apart from those doing architecture, medicine and a few other courses. Within roughly 5 years, assuming the return home rate stays the same, which we've no reason to suspect that it won't, outflows will equal inflows. And therefore, the problem over students and net migration will simply evaporate. The numbers will come into balance, and so students will no longer contribute to net migration. And the IPPR's point is, if this is going to happen, if you like, through natural causes by 2017, 2018, why is the government so keen to cut students in the short term? And the IPPR's answer, coming from where it does in the political spectrum, is it's the general election in 2015, stupid. So that really is the IPPR's argument. There is no reason to have a short-term cut in student numbers. Net migration actually will sort itself out in the, if you like, relatively short to medium term. We are expecting there to be a review of all the visitor visa routes later on this year. That's if the border agency ever recovers from the Olympics. The particular aspect that concerns us, of course, as a sector, is the special concession. It is a ministerial concession outside the immigration rules for English language courses of the extended student visitor visa, which means that you can come for up to 11 months on a student visitor visa to take an English language course. And hopefully, even if you're from a difficult language group like Arabic, Chinese, Russian, different character set, non-Indo-Germanic, etc., you can probably still get from near beginner to level B2 or thereabouts within about 11 months. This actually has been a very major help to us, and in our view, it's vital to preserve it. That will become, I think, a battleground because the overall politics of this is that there appears to be a division at the top of government between roughly numbers 10 and 11, with Jeremy Hunt as cabinet minister ultimately responsible for tourism, having a Chinese wife, which helps, and Vince Cable on the business and growth side, against broadly Theresa May and William Hague over the whole sort of tourism area. Cameron made a speech on tourism in August last year in which he queried why the UK gets far fewer students than, say, France and Germany. France gets 9 times more Chinese tourists than we do, and Germany gets about 5 times more Chinese tourists than we do. The answer, it's the visa system, stupid. Sorry, it is. That is actually the thing that counts. There is a battle going on about tourism and its contribution to the growth agenda. And doubtless our little bit of the action on the student visitor visa and the extended student visitor visa will be in that heady mix of high-level politics. A subsidiary thing which certainly our private sector members would like is that come next year, when, if the educational oversight bodies can be believed, and I'm not too sure about that personally, but if they can be, by next year everybody will be educational oversight by QAA and ISI. Everybody will be highly trusted sponsor status if they're going to bring students in on tier four visas. At that point, the argument for a differential towards the state sector on student work rights seems to us to evaporate. And there really ought to be a level playing field across everybody who's HTS as to what work rights their students have. And whether that's, as Jeremy said, I came in at the end of his answering questions earlier on, if that's just vacation time or whether it's 10 hours a week in vacation or 20 hours a week, don't really care about the details as long as actually there's a level playing field. Possibly also the important thing coming out of the UK, and I was talking to Beatrice and others about this, and Joe earlier on, we have damaged ourselves very much by highly negative mood music, which has been amplified by global media. The US has not actually significantly changed its student visa regime over the last 2 or 3 years. But the Obama effect and the US mood music has changed very significantly, and it seems to have worked. Now, going back to Cameron, he made this speech on tourism August last year. When has he ever made a significant speech on the value of international education to the UK? And why not? And why doesn't he? If we actually are serious about this as part of the growth agenda, then we really want to see support from the very top of government, just like Blair and the Prime Minister's initiative, which some of you in this room are old enough to remember. The final thing, which I've suggested before, in Australia, the government commissioned a review of the student visa policy and system by Derek Knight. That has been very positive, certainly for the higher education sector in Australia, possibly less so for their TAFE sector and their English language sector. There's no sign of the government doing that, but I'd like to put down a challenge to the sector. Why don't we do it ourselves? Why don't we commission Lord Patton and Lord Krebs and a few others of the great and the good actually to lead a serious review with a few of those, Nobel Prize winners who said, well, if it hadn't been for the UK welcoming international students, I wouldn't be a professor at the University of Manchester, etc. I think that could be a very powerful way forward to throw down a gauntlet to government. And I think it's about time we actually did that. Thank you for your time and attention.
Perfect. Thanks very much, Tony.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.